This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Signature support comes from First Financial Tax and Accounting Services. Our emails are at talk@talklouisiana.org. Rob and Dow ready to take your call at 877-217-5757. Emails to talk@talklouisiana.org. Kevin Cope is in the house. For almost 40 years, he's been large and in charge at Allen Hall at LSU, professor of English. And for much of his tenure at Tigertown, he was the head of the Faculty Senate. We're 2 years into the tenure of one William Tate IV, who is the president of LSU, the flagship campus, and the system as a whole. And he has benefited from a time in which money has been more plentiful than it was during the King Alexander years, when the king faced 13 budget cuts. What's your perception of Dr. Tate?
I will say that we have at LSU at least a degree of stability. That is one thing in favor of the regime of Bill Tate. On the other hand, stability often comes at a big price, and one of those prices is the apparent lack of any kind of intellectual leadership. That is, it's not clear exactly what is going on with respect to the LSU system with regard to encouraging research or the taking of controversial positions or the showcasing of the intellectual life at LSU. I believe it was the LSU Reveille that recently pointed out that Bill Tate has done very little to promote the humanities and liberal arts, and instead going after the big money and the big media sorts of disciplines.
Well, Bill Tate is a guy who's made no mistake about his points on the media, which he does not like. He is not a fan of mass media, believes we're out to get him. He has declined an opportunity to be on this show. But a few days ago, I think Robin Dow has a sampling of this. Dr. Tate went on a show in New Orleans with Corey Johnson, veteran broadcaster, son of the great Phil Johnson. And Dr. Tate kind of lost it when when Corey Johnson had the audacity to ask him why the physics department wasn't as good as the football team. Here's how it sounded.
On the health side, in the top 25% in America, one of the very best of its type. Our leadership program and resource development program, top 25% in America. That physics program that you continually bemoan about is one of the top 25% programs in America. Our finance program, one of the top 25% in America. The problem is you're prone to the negative instinct. And that's just what happens in journalism. Everything is negative and no incremental growth is ever seen. We're not the same LSU that you attended. You couldn't probably get on the LSU today.
All right. He took a shot at him, even said that he could find out. And I didn't think presidents of universities should be snooping around. He's free to snoop around about me if he wants to. My academic career, I'm sure, is available. But to come out and say that, that took some brass, Kevin Cope.
First of all, I'm always learning from you, Jim, and to discover that President Tate has three things in common with Donald Trump: a detestation of the mass media, a paranoia, and a tendency to call for probes of enemies. This is a remarkable conjunction of personal habits. But that having been said, notice in that little tirade two things. Number one is that the search firms in America are always putting premiums on educational executives who can keep their cool, and that didn't happen. So this was certainly a strategic mistake for President Tate, who is certainly already thinking about his next job, given that we've got a likelihood of Republican governor coming in. And number two, notice the immediate drift towards the finance program. Well, I'm in favor of the finance program, but when are we going to start talking about music history, Syrian languages, perhaps even biology with its ardent devotion to the old theory of evolution?
He even took, if I heard him right, it was about a 40-minute interview, and God bless him, he actually talked with somebody, and Corey's a good interviewer. And he even made a little bit of a disparaging remark about, well, you went to the Manship School. Well, Manship School is nationally recognized. He didn't say anything kind about the English department either. He was mentioning some of these others. And LSU, of course, and I'll give him this, LSU in some areas is very highly regarded. And it is, if you're in one of those curricula that is highly regarded, it's a great university. But is it Corey was making the point that it may be great in those areas, but it's not even as great as the University of Alabama. If you look at the U.S. News and World Report and USA Today and these other rankings.
There you go. I don't think that there's anything to be gained by the promotion of balderdash. That is, LSU is a comprehensive university. It's a pretty formidable comprehensive university that offers a lot of opportunities. It is not really a great university by any available metric, as the educational administrators like to talk about it. It has great people. It has people who have dedicated their lives to learning, to educating. It has people who are extraordinary achievers in their field. But you don't have a great university when you have buildings that don't have hot water, where you've got mold on the ceilings, and whereas I think one of your guests said recently, you've got a basement in the library that becomes a frog pond.
Well, Dr. Tate, I know, based on conversations with LSU board members, was furious when the attorney for Sharon Lewis was on this show, thinking that I shouldn't be interviewing Larry English, and I disagree. And, of course, I'd be more than willing and happy to talk with Dr. Tate. He can sit in the chair you're sitting in right now, and we can have a discussion. And I admire his passion. He obviously got upset, and sometimes that's a good thing rather than just playing by the numbers. And that may be why he doesn't do many interviews, because he knows that if you hit the wrong nerve, he's going to explode.
Certainly. Passion is one of the most important human attributes and most important mental activities. And we would be in a sorry world if we didn't have any feeling, passion, and compassion. But if you're going to be a great university, if you're going to be even a comprehensive university, you've got to be prepared to talk to anybody, including the intimidating, the overwhelming, and the wonderfully articulate Jim Engster. If he's afraid to come into this studio, how in the world is he going to lead a university that's filled with people with some of the craziest ideas out there?
Well, he's from the south side of Chicago, and granted, he's no bad Leroy Brown, but I doubt that he's afraid to come in the studio. He just doesn't want to come in the studio, but we would love to have him. And when I see Dr. Tate face-to-face, we're always quite chummy with each other, but I know when I leave, he's saying, there's that. What was it George Bush said about Adam Clymer of the New York Times? I'm going to even say the word. He told Dick Cheney, he goes, there's a real asshole. And Cheney goes, major league.
I'll promote you. I'll put you up there with Sparrow Agnew in the effete corps of intellectuals.
Yes, the impudent snobs. That's what he called the media.
You got it.
Yeah, I remember. You and I are old enough to remember that. Now, Bill Tate disbanded this committee to rename buildings at LSU. And he was not responsible. His fingerprints are not on the General Middleton thing. That happened under Tom Galligan, taking Middleton's name off the library. But now we have learned that John James Audubon was a really bad boy, and there's been a hall at LSU for 100 years named in honor of the naturalist and illustrator who logged a lot of quality time in this area. But he bought and sold black people. He had 9 enslaved individuals working at his household in the 1810s when others spoke out in favor of abolishing slavery. In the 1830s, he wrote a letter to his wife that the British government had acted imprudently in emancipating enslaved people. He ransacked burial sites in North America, collected skulls of indigenous people, and he's accused of plagiarism and inventing bird species, among everything else. So how can we have John James Audubon's name on a building at Louisiana State University?
You've got 2 points here. First of all, the major mistake was disbanding that committee, because a university is about consultation, collaboration, conferring, and conversation. And when you undercut that, you immediately poison anything that follows from it. And so this flap, this controversy, this dispute over Audubon and the naming of buildings is an inevitable outcome of poisoning the well to begin with. Next, I would say that, yes, clearly, if we're going to rename, unname, upname some buildings, we have to be consistent. And if you've got this behavior of Audubon, that is not going to cut the mustard with regard to that standard. And finally, of course, we've always got the problem that the history of art, the history of culture is itself somewhat toxic. There are lots of people out there who have gotten into trouble who have still done great things. So if we had a real great comprehensive university, we could talk about how to separate the artistic product from the person who made it. But then again, how are we going to do that if we're disbanding committees?
877-217-5757, and a listener notes accurately, and thanks for remembering that William Tate was involved in adding Sue Gunner's name to the LSU basketball court, so he'll get involved in that, but he won't get involved in David Boyd being a Confederate and is overlooking the parade grounds, and John James Audubon, and you go down the list. They've got some bad actors whose names are still on buildings, and it seems like an awful place to start with General Middleton, who was a racist in his time. He moderated over time, but he also fought in two wars for the United States, gallantly and heroically, unlike David Boyd, who fought in a war against the United States of America.
Yes, that is certainly true. And this situation that you describe is only going to get worse if we have a change in the party that is in the governor's office. Because at that point, not only the president, but the entire LSU administration will have only two choices. They can either leave, which is a definite possibility, try to get promoted into some more affluent university, or they can suddenly become chummy. Now, you've got an administration that's got 60 people in it. I think a lot of them are going to come chummy with Jeff Landry or Billy Nungesser.
All right, 877-217. We're back after this. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Robin Dow is our producer, and your number is 877-217-5757. Another segment with Dr. Kevin Cope, who's coming up on 40 years as of August 18th at LSU. He's an authority, as we've noted, not only on English literature, but also on professional wrestling and much more. And now he knows the lay of the land at Tigertown. He came this way via Harvard University. So he's one of those guys who went to one of the most decorated universities in America. Tate was making the case that the student body now is much better than it was when I was in school and we had open admissions. Is it better?
It is certainly better by that testing metric. I do not know if it's really better with regard to preparation. That is, it is astounding what a change has taken place. While it is true that students are scoring higher and many of them seem to be rather cleverer than the students in the past, on the other hand, the readiness to pursue fields that are outside the vocational ones, in which they have not been prepared by professional testing services or whatnot, is not all that impressive. So that, of course, is a problem that goes back to the culture generally and to K through 12 and to our mania in Louisiana with education as a matter to be measured rather than a matter to be processed, assimilated, and contributing to a person's growth.
877-217-5757. And we commend Dr. Cope for coming in today. When we were originally scheduled to have him on Monday, he was dealing with his mother's death and was in Florida. And we certainly sympathize with you at this time. And your mom, I understand, lived a long and gallant life. So you were blessed to have a great mother, as was I. And that's one of the most, it is the most important thing, I think, in a person's life.
Definitely true, Jim. Thank you.
All right. Well, Dane Sherman was with us Monday, and your colleague at Southeastern has thrown his hat in the ring to be president of Southeastern Louisiana University. I like this. What do you think?
Yes, Jim, I would say that this is one of the most interesting developments in Louisiana higher education in recent years. Because, number one, this is bringing this contest for the presidency at SLU out into the open. Instead of the typical search run by a search firm or by a kangaroo court of a committee set up by one of the boards of supervisors, all of a sudden we've got somebody who's got the courage to take the competition into the public. Number two is, of course, there can be no doubt that Dame Sherman is probably the ideal candidate. He's homegrown, he's talented, he's in student service delivery in the library, he's a professor, he has everything that our educational leaders say they want. So if they don't hire Dame Sherman, either they're liars or Dane is going to qualify for some other position and be swept up to the leadership of Stanford.
Well, Dane is a good man, and he would be, as Rodney Dangerfield said of Sam Kinison in Back to School, he cares. He cares.
He certainly does. He certainly does.
He loves that university.
This candidacy is the acid test. Mm-hmm. If Dane doesn't get the job, then the entire range of propaganda put out by our educational leadership is false, and they are the perpetrators of falsehood, which I think is called liars.
All right. Now, Bob Mann, your good friend, Manship School chair, and he was mentioned a few days ago as a candidate for governor, and he knocked that down on this show. But you told me there's actually been some evidence on campus that there has been this move to get Mann in the race. What's going on?
Yes, there are some posters being distributed. They're being distributed in electronic form, and I think you have to print them up yourself, or maybe somebody's now printing them. They show the wondrous face of Bob Mann on a sort of purple indigo field, and then there's only one line, Bob Mann for governor, because the rest of the guys suck. And I agree with that 100%. You know how infrequently I agree with something 100%. So I'm strongly behind this, and I hope that Bob will throw his hat in the ring.
Hope he'll reconsider. But at this point, no indication that he is running. I think he will likely sit this one out. But he's also got a new book about Huey Long out. This would be a great way to promote his book.
It would be indeed a way to promote his book and for Bob Mann personally to channel Huey Long in a public campaign, both to be governor and to sell a book. That would be an extraordinary media event, to be sure.
And Holly in the Garden District says that Kim Mulkey should run for governor. And if she ran now, if they win the national title, what a way to go and then become governor. That would be an amazing. She's from Stangepole Parish, where the last governor came from.
Well, there you go again. And talk about channeling people. Kim Mulkey's clearly channeling Liberace or Michael Jackson or whatever. So there we would have the memory of another celebrity in the office.
Yeah, well, she is the toast of the town. And I'll give Scott Woodward credit. This is a program that lost $6 million last year. $6 million in red ink. And in most cases, that would not be considered successful. But people are juiced up about women's basketball like they've never been before. And LSU is now two games away from winning the national championship. So Kim Mulkey has become a force of nature in this community overnight, it would seem.
Sure. And I would say that deficit has to be understood with regard to, as it were, the moral deficit in Louisiana with regard to women's sports. Now, as you know, I'm not a great enthusiast about collegiate sports, but if we're going to look at collegiate sports, the differential in support between that given to women athletes and that given to male athletes, pretty substantial. So the $5 million there, that can easily come out of Scott Woodward's back pocket and maybe borrow it from, Kelly, the coach, or whoever he is.
Uh-huh. Here's a question from Henry in Prairieville. I think this is different than Henry at the Country Club, who we haven't heard from in a while. But he asks about another gun incident at a school, and now we've had one recently on a college campus at Michigan State. Does that give you pause?
Yes. I think anyone who is in public education from K all of the way up through graduate school has to be made worried about this. And unfortunately, the matter is getting worse across the culture at large. Now, here is an opportunity where President Tate could show both intellectual and social leadership. Why is he not out there forming a confederacy of sorts with other university presidents to talk about gun violence? It is shocking how silent the administrations across higher education are on these major topics.
I walk the campus. I live nearby, and about a mile away, and it's a nice walk. And when I walk there at night, I never felt unsafe, even though it was dark. But now, if you walk through LSU at midnight, it's like Coney Island. There are lights everywhere. But as we know, lights do not stop an Uzi.
No, certainly not. And there again, there is a kind of curious vacancy, both physically. Sometimes the campus is outright spooky with all those lights and nobody around. But there's also a leadership vacancy. That is, when I was in faculty senate office, I tried again and again to talk about the safety of the classrooms and the fact that most of those classrooms, there's no way to get out. Well, the police made their little video about run, fight, hide, or whatever it is, and that's well and good. But if you're backed into a corner in one of these old-fashioned, poorly designed classrooms, you're not going to be able to do any of that.
Kate asked if you had the option to carry a weapon, would you do so?
No, I don't think so, because I don't want to come to the point in my life, or I think in the life of the university, where we are some kind of shooting gallery or Wild West or Streets of Dodge. I think this is just plain inappropriate for a higher education institution. It's not the battlefields of Beirut in 1970.
Well, that is, according to some, a prescription for curbing gun violence. But as we know, a pistol is not a high prescription move with an assault weapon on the other side. And yesterday, Troy Hebert was saying, well, these people didn't have assault weapons. They would be using knives. Well, let's put somebody with a knife up against somebody with an assault weapon and see what happens.
Well, I agree with you. I heard that show and those incidents that he's talking about in the streets of Europe with daggers. Yes, they were terrible, and yes, they killed some people, but nothing anywhere near the numbers of some of these shooting sprees that we've seen, whether in public places like Las Vegas or in higher education or K through 12 institutions.
What will it take to change the inertia? Right now, our congressional delegation, and this would have to be done on a federal level based on decisions from the Supreme Court, which would probably mean a state could not just go off on its own and put in some kind of draconian, as some would say, gun safety rules. But what would have to happen to change the thought pattern and the voting pattern of people on Capitol Hill?
I don't think there's really much hope at the moment, to be honest. But if there is any hope, it again comes down to some help from the leadership or some sort of discouragement issued by the persons who are in charge of higher education institutions with regard to this kind of behavior, simply making it uncool. Why is it that people carry these guns? Well, they want to look tough or they want to get in the media or whatever. If you take that away, you've at least removed one incentive.
Well, thank you very much, Kevin Cope. Back after this. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for being with us for Talk Louisiana. Robin Dow is our producer, and our guest at this time is one of our favorites, the legendary Dennis Dale McClain, the only man to win 30 games in a major league season since the year of 1934. He was the MVP, the Cy Young Award winner, came back the next year and did it again for the Tigers. Detroit won it all in the year of 1968, and today is Denny's birthday. Happy birthday, my friend, the great right-hander number 17.
Thank you, my friend. Thank you.
And Denny, it's hard for you to believe, and I'm sure for anybody who witnessed your career, that it was 60 years ago, as here we are on opening day, 60 years ago that you made your debut in the major leagues as a teenager.
As a matter of fact, it was said to me by a good friend of mine this morning, and he reminded me how old I was, and I said, I said, you know, when anybody wants to talk about my age, that's fine. It's like, because I've got my mother's constitution. She lived to be 84. And I said, that's okay. That's fine. I said, but today I am turning, 40 for the second time. That's all. I mean, it's pretty close to that. And
not quite.
Listen, to be honest with you, it's a miracle as far as I'm concerned, too. I mean, it's all the crazy things I've done in my life to still be here. Mm-hmm. It's kind of a nice feeling. I'm in Florida right now. I had dinner all week with my daughter. I've had a wonderful time. I mean, except for the humidity here, which is overwhelming, although it's supposed to clear up in the next day or so. But the pollen is beyond belief the last couple of days.
Well, Denny McClain has crammed about five lifetimes into one. His father died when he was 36 years old. Denny is now more than doubled that. But you lived a large life as a young man, 24, when you got adulation that was unparalleled for one season. He did everything in 1968, and you were king of the world, highest paid player in the game before you were 25 years old. And then along the way, you weren't a man who lived a temperate life. You drank 100 Pepsis a day at one point, didn't you?
Well, not quite 100. But, people don't realize I was with Pepsi for like 27 years. And, I mean, what they used to do is they would bring out at least once or twice a month a big pickup, not a pickup truck, but a big van, and they would unload Pepsi in our garage. So there was always Pepsi. But I would, the worst I was, or the worst, depending on what word you want to use, I used to drink 15, well, at a minimum 15 up to 24, 25. Now, my wife said, when she was still with us, she'd say, you opened them. You didn't drink them all. She says, there's six cans or six bottles around the house every hour of every day. So that's probably more accurate. But totally, I drank a lot. Thank and you. Listen, my doctor just 3 months ago, Jimmy, told me this. You've been drinking Pepsi-Cola for 100 years. and you've been eating Twinkies for 100 years. I said, yep. He said, don't change your diet now.
Well, you enjoy it, and it's worked with you, kind of, and you've managed to withstand all kinds of health issues, and some of them related to your career. You once said on this show, if I remember correctly, Denny, that you, in your career, had over 300 cortisone shots.
Yeah, not quite 300, but 200, and I think it was 226.
Well,
you know, nobody knew back then what it would do to you. And I tell everybody, how have you lived so long? I said, I had a lot of cortisone. I mean, my body doesn't know what to do. But I tell you, I hated the thought of the shots, because those shots have to be precise to be effective. And out of probably the 200 and something, half of them missed. And that was always because you had to wait for the Xolocaine to wear off to see if it was working for a day or so. And a day or so, half the time was they had missed the spot. You have to go back and get another one. And, you know, I always said, they're going to put enough needles in there, we'll start bleeding through all these holes.
Well, you're a man of the world, and you learned the world at a young age. And even though you were not a college guy, because you went right into baseball out of high school, you learned a lot, and you were a student of humanity and of life in general. And at 25, you were already an accomplished pilot. You were one of the best organists and pianists in the world. And you were one of the best bowlers in the world. And those were all, quote, hobbies. But when you think about it, and I know you have, you've even said it on this show, all of those were helpful to your baseball career. The eye-hand coordination and the bowling is one of those arm exercises where you're not putting the pressure on your shoulder and elbow that you do if you throw overhand. Your thoughts about how those helped you when you were in your heyday?
And any father out there who's got a son, or mother that's got a son that thinks they've got some exceptional ability, they should listen to this for just a second. And I'm not trying to tell you what to do. If I had not bowled the way, and I had bowled from the time I was 12, 13 years old, but when I really took it up, I was a partner in a bowling alley. I was a minor partner too, nothing dramatic. So I had access to the bowling alley all the time. And so starting the 1 year in 1967, when I hurt my arm really seriously for the first time, I started bowling to build up my shoulder, and it got better and better and better. And so in 1966, I may have these years messed up, my arm was starting to feel better only because of the bowling. And then in the winter of 67, that's where it is, in the winter of 67, I started bowling 100 lines a day, 6 days a week, every day through the entire winter. And after I got in pitching shape, which is different than the shape I was in when I got there, because I was in great shape with my legs and every part of my body was great, because I'm bowling 100 lines a day. And I noticed something about halfway through spring training, my fastball all of a sudden was better than it ever was. And I always had a good one. But all of a sudden, I was throwing the ball near 100 miles an hour.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm thinking, my God, look what bowling has finally done. And I it didn't ring on me right away, but sometime during the 68 season, somebody said, where the hell did this exceptional fastball come from? I said, bowling, pal, bowling. He said, well, did you ever make a 7-10? I said, one time in my entire life I made a 7-10. I said, I can tell you the date. So that's where it came from, and I want to tell parents out there, I know it's a lot more expensive now to bowl than ever before, but the bottom line is, if you have a pitcher, let him bowl. Just don't make operations out of things. Just don't make it an experiment. But do what you can to build up the side that he produces from. And I'm talking about pitchers only. So, and I know a lot of guys now with younger children. Now, I'm not talking about a 6-year-old or 10-year-old or 12-year-old going out there pulling 50 lines. I'm just talking about kids who have that look like they have the ability. This could be the little hump you get over, and you pick up that velocity, because nobody gets the professional baseball. Certainly nobody gets to the big leagues without a fastball, a good one. And then all of a sudden you've got there, they've given you $1 million, not when I played, but now they give them $1 million, and then all of a sudden they start changing their windup. They start changing their pitches. I don't get it. They've been undefeated in college, undefeated in high school, and all of a sudden they're geniuses at the major league level to say, okay, now we don't need all that movement. Well, that may be true, but that's how he got there. Leave him alone until he proves he can't do it. And fortunately for me, they let me do what I did.
Well, Major League Baseball returns today. All 30 teams are in action. It's opening day. 12 hours of continuous MLB action with a 15-game slate. And it's always hope springs eternal. I'm sure in Detroit, people believe this is a year the Tigers turn the corner. But for pitchers, there will be a pitch clock this year. What do you think of that?
Listen, it sucks. I mean, I don't know what they're trying. I know what they're trying to accomplish. But you know the first thing they got to do, you know, and I'll explain why real quick. They got to raise the mound back to 16 inches. The game was played on a 16-inch mound for 100 years. All of a sudden, we have a genius, and I like the commissioner. He's a good guy, good personality. I know he's trying to help the game. But you do not tell a pitcher that he's got to, I mean, when pitchers get in trouble, and I know I was one of them when I got in trouble, I'd take an extra minute and a half. I'd throw over to first base 3, 4, or 5 times. Hell, today you won't even be able to throw the ball over there more than twice or three times. I mean, I don't know what – speed up the game, yes, but make it reasonable. Make it reasonable. Do something easy. Raise the mound. When in 68, when they reduced the mounds by 6 inches, by 1974 or 75, 19 or 20 of the stars in baseball, the pitchers, were either hurt or out of the game by then because of arm injuries by lowering the mound. It put so much pressure on their shoulder, on their back, on their legs. I mean, it was incredible. And they didn't care. They just didn't care. No matter how we screamed, they didn't care. Today, they could never get away with it, with the union as strong as our union is today. But it's crazy. It's just crazy. But our Tigers, I don't know. I've seen them play 3 times this spring, and we got a long way to go. And our biggest problem, of course, is pitching, like everybody else. Mm-hmm.
You know, the other day, speaking of the Tigers, I looked up this. Now you can argue with this assessment, but that wins above replacement is what they now determine a lot of things on, especially Hall of Fame voting. The highest wins above replacement guy in the history of the game, not in the Hall of Fame, who wasn't tainted by steroids, is a guy named Sweet Lou Whitaker of the Tigers. Why isn't he in the Hall of Fame?
Well, in fact, I was with Lou the other night, and it looks great. He looks like he can still play. I don't know. I think it's got to do to some degree with black, white, green, yellow. I think it's got a lot more to do now with the players being involved so much politically. I think that's got a lot to do with it. We've put some guys in lately that, and I'm not going to name them, but probably were on the edge. Lou Whitaker, and I don't know Lou real well. I've only been with him a few times. Lou Whitaker was a real major leaguer. He was with Alan Trammell during his entire career.
And Alan is in the Hall of Fame. And we'll be back to wrap it up with the great Denny McClain after this quick timeout on Talk Louisiana. This is Jim Inkster, and we're wrapping it up with the legendary Denny McClain. Happy birthday to Dennis Dale McClain, who lost his wife, Sharon, for a few years ago, lost a daughter in a car accident tragically many years ago, and as stated, lived a life of highs and lows like few other men, and yet is still around to talk about it, and was the top-rated radio talk host in Detroit after he retired for a time, owned the Michigan Radio Network. He's a man of many lives, and some would say 9 lives, Denny McClain.
Well, the good news is, as I get older, I forget a lot of the bad stuff.
You are That's a resilient man, I must say... I know you have made mistakes, as all of us have, but you have learned from them, and you inspire me with your tenacity. You are a tough, tough guy. So happy birthday, my friend.
Thank you very much. And by the way, I'm coming down to Louisiana pretty soon, so I'm going to call you and we can go to lunch or something.
I would love that. Denny, thank you, my friend, and God bless you. Happy birthday.
Have a great day. Thank you, everybody. Bye-bye.
And we're joined now by, is it Nicole? Nicole is with us, okay. We've got Nicole Hockley, who is a name that many are familiar with because she lost a child in the Sandy Hook shooting. And she did something that is heroic in her way. She went out and tried to make a difference and is continuing to do so. And, of course, as we know, in Louisiana, gun laws are sacrosanct in many areas, including this area. But yet, when we have these mass shootings over and over with assault weapons in schools, killing kids who are defenseless, who don't deserve this, and their parents don't deserve it, what can we do? It seems pretty evident we could do something, and we had a ban on assault weapons in this country not so long ago, and the world didn't stop, and we didn't have these kinds of mass shootings. Nicole Hockley, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me, Jim. I appreciate it.
Well, tell us about your voyage, which is the most personal voyage anybody could have. That was one of the most horrendous days in American history, and you lost a child.
Yes, both of my sons were at Sandy Hook School the day of the shooting, and my youngest, Dylan, was killed in his first grade classroom. And I've been on a mission ever since then to do all that I can to stop these shootings from happening and keep kids safe and families whole. It's my way of honoring him and my way of providing a better future for my surviving son and all the other kids like him.
Nicole is the founder and CEO of Sandy Hook Promise Action Fund. Now, I think public opinion in the United States is such, among even many conservatives, that the public would be supportive of a ban on assault weapons if it went to a vote of the American people. But that is not likely to happen. And why do these lawmakers kowtow to the gun industry so mightily?
I wish I had an answer to that question, because I agree with you. Most Americans, I mean, nobody is pro-gun violence. Let's put it that way. Everyone wants school shootings to stop. Everyone wants gun violence to stop. But sometimes our politics and our politicians seem to get in the way of having a genuine conversation about what these solutions could be, and things like assault weapon bans. There's other legislation that polls really high. You know, universal background checks polls higher than baseball and apple pie. So these are things that people want, and our politicians just aren't listening to us as they should be.
And we know this will not stop. And truth is, it won't stop completely, even if there's a ban. There are too many guns out there now. But where do we start, and when do we say enough?
Well, for me, I said enough 10 years ago. And for Nashville, enough was on Monday. And this does continue to happen. And I think we do have a lot of guns in America, more guns than people. And that is not going to change. So I think sometimes we need to stop thinking about the spectacle of the lack of progress in gun safety policy or a reduction in guns, because that's not going to happen. And what can we do with the guns there to help us recognize the signs of someone who might need help or should not have access to that firearm? Or what can we do to ensure our firearms are securely stored so that they can't be accessed by someone who could be intent on hurting themselves or someone else? There's a lot that we can do. And I think, you know, when I hear from other countries and they say, oh, well, we got rid of guns, that is a solution, but it's not something that's going to happen in the United States. So let's work with firearm owners. Let's work with non-firearm owners and work together to... What we all agree on is that we want to keep our families safe. So what's the best way to do that? And there's a lot of options there if we can get past our political division.
Nicole Hockley is with us, the CEO or founder of the Sandy Hook Promise Action Fund. And she took thought and made it into action. And, of course, she lost her son, Dylan, in the Sandy Hook shooting. And I know it's hard, and it has to be a case in which you relive that every time one of these things happen. But what do you remember most about Dylan?
I remember his smile. He had a huge smile and a really high-pitched laugh that would bring a smile to everybody else's face. And I'm grateful for how much he loved to have long, deep cuddles. And I miss that desperately about him.
And I'm sure it's hard for you to fathom that he would be almost a grown man today.
Right now, he should be a junior in high school. My surviving son is a freshman in college right now. He was 8 at the time of the shooting. And yeah, Dylan should be, he should be 17 years old right now. And that, I think a lot about that, you know, how tall would he be? What would he be doing? But he's really still frozen in Forever Six.
Mm-hmm. A listener asks, how prevalent is the gun industry in campaign contributions? Is that a factor?
It certainly has been a factor historically. I think the gun lobbying industry has had disproportionate influence in U.S. politics historically. They still exert some influence, but their influence is significantly lesser than it was before. I think now it's more our own extreme politicians that sometimes get in the way and even might use the gun lobby as an excuse, but really they don't exert the power that they used to.
Well, these lawmakers, particularly in this area of the country, they are afraid, I think, to challenge the gun industry. And we're talking not only Republicans, we're talking Democrats too. Now, this goes way beyond Second Amendment rights. This makes us a killing field. And we had a guest yesterday, a bright man, former lawmaker, who said that if they weren't using assault weapons, they'd be using knives. Well, give me a break. You can't take out a classroom with a knife, but you can with an assault weapon, and you can do it quickly.
Yes, that's absolutely true. And when you look at the number of firearms we have in the U.S. and the number of firearm violence, gun violence we have in the U.S., we are like hugely greater than any other country. It's completely disproportionate what we do. And I think there are such extremes going on in our country right now. And I think that some politicians are afraid of still touching this issue and standing on the right side of history and doing the right thing because they think that this will damage their political career or this could change their campaign contributions or their base. They really need to be remembered that they are elected officials that are representing their constituents in the country, and they need to do the right thing because they are failing. They're failing all of us by not passing sensible gun safety legislation.
Peter in Mid-City, please be brief. You're on with Nicole. Hi, Peter.
Hello. I wonder if it's within the government's power to utilize the National Guard and make sure that there's, an armed soldier at every single school, because it seems as though, an assault weapons ban isn't going to eliminate the problem.
All right. Is that a practical way of approaching this, Nicole? To have an armed guard at every school? And of course, as we know, some schools have guards.
Yeah, I hear what you're saying, and I have to disagree, because school shootings are one part of gun violence. There's firearm violence at supermarkets, at churches and synagogues, in malls, in parks, on streets. We can't, the argument of more guns and more security will make us a safer nation isn't proving to be true. So a lot of schools do have security already. And quite often they're the first people to die. And that is unfortunately the sad truth. So I hear what you're saying, but I'd rather focus on what can we do to prevent these crises from happening in the first place, rather than focus money and infrastructure on what do we do when they're happening. It's better to prevent than to deal with something, a tragedy in the moment. That's how I would answer that.
Well, thank you for your resilience and your courage and your action. Nicole Hockley, the founder of Sandy Hook Promise Action Fund, and you can find out more if you go on the World Wide Web, the Sandy Hook Promise Action Fund. Thank you so much, Nicole.
Thank you.
First Financial Tax and Accounting provides signature support.